Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded March 13th, 2024. Well, Sunday past marked the beginning of Ramadan, Islam's holy month, marking the first revelations to the Prophet. There had been hope and some hints by U.S. President Biden a ceasefire would be agreed, but those hopes died with Israel's bombing of Rafah, the city harboring more than 1.5 million displaced Palestinians, survivors of Israel's now 5 months-long genocide campaign. Dimitri Lascaris is an activist, journalist, and lawyer. His interviews for TRNN are at therealnews.com, and his articles appear at his website, dimitrilascaris.org, where you can, too, find the recent interviews and videos he's produced during his months-long trek across the Middle East. As Hollywood celebrated itself Sunday with the Oscars and Israel bombed the civilians of Rafah, Dimitri spent the first night of Ramadan in East Jerusalem, outside the gates to Al-Aqsa Mosque. Dimitri Lascaris in the first half. And there's been an effort to paint the genocide in Gaza and growing pogrom in communities of the West Bank and East Jerusalem in the colors of a religious war. The Battle of Civilizations narrative is a familiar one. We've heard it variously intoned during all of the many conflicts the United States and its allies have fomented across the so-called arc of instability for the last 20 years and more, and each time it's been a lie. But to what purpose? Dr. T.J. Coles is the director of the Plymouth Institute for Peace Research and the author of numerous books, including The War on You, Manufacturing Terrorism, Capitalism and Coronavirus, How Institutionalized Greed Turned a Crisis into a Catastrophe, Biofascism, the Tech Pharma Complex and the End of Democracy, among others. His essays can be found at Counterpunch, where his recent piece, The New Atheism at 20, How an Intellectual Movement Exploited Rationalism to Promote War, appears. His latest book is The New Atheism Hoax, Exposing the Politics of Dawkins, Dennett, Harris, and Hitchens. T.J. Coles in the second half. But first, Dimitri Lascaris in the middle of the Middle East. Welcome back to the show, Dimitri.
Thank you for having me, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Well, the pleasure's all mine, naturally. Now, I used to, you know, Dimitri, introduce you as the Montreal-based activist, journalist, and lawyer, but now you have two bases of operation, and the other one provides you a much easier access to Western Asia. Now, can we start, Dimitri, at the end point of your recent month-long tour throughout the Middle East, Palestine? What have you seen in the West Bank and Jerusalem? And I noticed you've been posting so many videos. Another one popped up just today from Jenin.
I started, actually just arrived in Jerusalem on the night when Ramadan began, and there were a lot of concerns that because of comments made by right-wing fanatics like Ben-Gavir in Netanyahu's cabinet, that they would completely or substantially block the Muslim population of East Jerusalem from accessing Al-Aqsa. They did restrict entry for a lot of young men, young Muslim men, but I was able to get in for some reason. They didn't ask me if I was Muslim. I think, were focusing more on my age than anything, and I witnessed something extraordinary, you know, on top of Al-Aqsa that night, and I talked about that in a video report. I went to Sheikh Jarrah, the neighborhood in East Jerusalem, where there has been very aggressive efforts on the part of Jewish settlers with the help of Israeli courts to dispossess Palestinian families of their homes. And then I came to Jenin, the refugee camp, where I saw evidence of extraordinary and really shocking atrocities, I mean, both yesterday and this morning. And this afternoon I went to Tulkar refugee camp, where I saw more evidence of, frankly, terrorizing the civilian population of the camp and causing massive damage to civilian infrastructure. So, you know, it's one thing to see video reports and hear accounts of these things, which is, you know, is terrible enough, but to see this with one's own eyes is really is difficult to stomach. And I cannot imagine, Chris, what it's like to actually have to live with it day after day.
Well, and year after year, what has this increased? I mean, it's been going on forever, but I mean, has this increased since October the 7th, or even more recently? Is there a ramping up in the West Bank and East Jerusalem of the kind of behavior we've seen from both the military and settler populations there?
I don't know whether in the camps there's been a ramping up since October 7th, but based on everything I've heard and seen, there has been an enormous ramping up, you know, as compared to what was happening prior to October 7th. You know, it just seems like there's been a relentless attempt on the part of the Israeli military, the settlers, the Israeli police in the West Bank to maximize the suffering. There's a lot of vindictiveness. It's a kind of a lower level genocide. I would characterize it that way than we are witnessing in Gaza. But I, and this is really, I think, maybe the overarching objective of my reporting from the West Bank. It's that people need to understand that this is not a genocide that's confined to Gaza.
Yeah.
This is a generalized genocide being perpetrated upon the Palestinian people in occupied territory. And who knows, it may spread to the Palestinian population living within the sovereign boundaries of Israel. That doesn't appear to have happened yet, but that would not at all surprise me based on what I've seen.
Yeah, well, you describe it in your latest video report, and you're putting these up at you can link to them through your website, DimitriLascaris.org, but they're also up at YouTube for the time being, at least. The censorship there has been an issue as well. But you put up a piece just today in Jenin, Israeli snipers shoot dead unarmed men fleeing into a hospital. People might not be aware, Dimitri, that there's these operations that the Israeli military conducts on a regular basis in the middle of the night, going into various places in the West Bank, kicking in doors and dragging out hostages essentially to prison. And was this what was going on in Jenin in the early hours this morning when the shootings occurred?
Well, that I think was probably an objective. I'll tell you what I know. And you're quite right that this happens on a virtual nightly basis. What I know is that last night at approximately 3 a.m., there was another ongoing military incursion into the Jenin refugee camp. And at some point, a number of young men gathered in the courtyard of the Jenin governmental hospital, which is on the edge of the Jenin refugee camp and is right across the street from the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority police, which looks more like a military base than a police station, frankly. And at some point, as these young men were gathered in the courtyard, I think they went there to seek refuge. Snipers began to fire upon them. And they ran into the hospital emergency ward. I viewed security camera videotapes. They were shown to me by the general director of the hospital, who kindly agreed to be interviewed, which showed very clearly that a man fleeing into the hospital was shot in the back just as he entered the emergency ward, fell forward in a pool of blood, didn't move again, seemed to have been killed instantly. And when he was lifted and dragged from the spot where he was shot, there was no weapon visible at all. There's no indication that he was armed. And this is what the witnesses to the shooting said, that none of these men were armed. Two of them were killed and four of them were wounded. At the time we went to the hospital, the other four were being treated. And they were buried very quickly this morning, more quickly than is usual, because there were reports amongst the camp residents that there were masked, or I should say disguised, agents of the Israeli military in the camp. And so they didn't want to hold the funeral with the large gathering in the normal manner. They tried to do it as quickly and as discreetly as possible. And the other thing I can say is that when I showed up this morning at the camp, they had clearly done a lot of damage to the infrastructure that they had not done the night before. They go in there every night with a D9 military bulldozer, just about every night, and they tear up the streets. And then the Palestinians come out, and these are cramped camps, and the streets are relatively narrow. And they do whatever they can to repair the damage. You know, which isn't much, but at least they make the streets reasonably passable. And then the Israelis go in again with the D9 military bulldozer, and they make it even worse than it was before they fixed it up. And they also repeatedly destroy monuments. They'll, you know, every day the monuments seem to be more and more defaced. And the one at the entrance to Jenin is a monument called Al-Auda, which is the return. And on that monument, it's a circular monument, large one. They have a flag, a map of the country of Palestine, and the names of all the villages from which these refugees come in historic Palestine. That's all it is. And the Israelis have done everything they can to destroy that monument. So these are the things that are going on. I saw so many houses that have been demolished, burnt out, partially destroyed. I saw today in the Tulkarm refugee camp, an EU-funded, UNRWA-operated daycare center, multi-story, that had been demolished, almost flattened by the Israeli military in January of this year. These are flagrant war crimes, Chris, and they meet the classic definition of terrorism. This is a terrorization of the civilian population and destruction of civilian infrastructure for a political purpose, which is to make life unlivable for the Palestinians and cause them to abandon their homeland. So it falls squarely within the conventional definition of terrorism.
Yeah, it seems like a policy of erasure, not only historically, but in the current context, that they want to erase everything that makes life livable, as you say. And if you've seen it in the most gruesome form in Gaza, but as you say, we're not seeing much of it happening in the West Bank and Jerusalem, not in the media on this side of the Atlantic, at least.
Yes, and I guess I don't know why I'm surprised, but I'm surprised it's as bad as it is in the West Bank. I didn't realize it was this bad. I mean, right now I can hear gunfire out the window. I'm not in the camp. I'm not within shooting distance of the camp, but I'm close enough to the camp right now. I'm in the town of Jenin, not in the camp. And I mean, literally, I can hear gunfire. It's almost nonstop. And today there were drones circling overhead. I could see them in the sky, and you can hear them constantly for hours and hours on end circling over the camp. And, you know, these drones are capable of killing people in an instant. So as one camp resident told me, a very eloquent artistic director of a theater called the Freedom Theater in Jenin, they live with the thought that at any moment, at any time of the day or night, they could die. I can't even imagine what that's like.
Well, that's a well-founded fear too. The Freedom Theater has been targeted many times by the occupying force.
Yes, it has. That was destroyed actually during the Second Intifada, and this time around they rebuilt it. At the time, I think it was called the Stone Theater. They rebuilt it, called it the Freedom Theater. It dates all the way back to the 1980s. And the artistic director told me that within days of the October 7th attacks, very brutal, he said he'd never seen this level of brutality from Israeli soldiers. They stormed the theater, beat savagely the leadership of the theater, and took them off to some kind of a temporary holding area, beat them some more, held them in deplorable conditions. And one of them, I believe he's the producer, is still in prison some 3 months later. And they scrawled the the Star of David on the walls of the theater. And what he described to me is just sheer terrifying. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I think it's very important for people to understand, as I've said before, I said earlier in this conversation, this is not a genocide that's confined to Gaza. And if we don't stop what's happening in Gaza, obviously we should stop that first and foremost for the sake of the people of Gaza. But nobody should have any illusions that that level of depravity will then shift to the West Bank. If they can get away with that, they aren't stopping there.
Yeah, it seems that there's nothing, I don't know what short of military intervention is going to stop them at this point. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dimitri Lascaris. Dimitri is an activist, journalist, and lawyer. His interviews for TRNN are at therealnews.com. His articles appear at his website, dimitrilascaris.org, where you can also find his recent interviews and videos from his month-long trek across the Middle East. Dimitri, they were celebrating, you were arriving and standing in outside of Al-Aqsa on Sunday, Hollywood was celebrating itself at the Oscars. And it's a tale of two Oscars, in a sense, two awardees giving political speeches. One, the Oscar for a documentary on Navalny, the Russian activist, giving a big speech on Ukraine, very propagandistic and not interrupted as it went over long. The other, a brief mention of Gaza. by the director Glaser of the film that was about the Nazi Holocaust and about Auschwitz and the family, the director of that institution living just on the other side of a wall. Did the awards make any impression, these two speeches in Palestine?
Well, I haven't heard anybody talk specifically about, you know, the Oscars. I think there's virtually nobody, at least in occupied Palestine, who was paying attention to the Oscars. I've only been able to read snippets about the coverage or the speeches from the Western press. And I mean, I can comment on my views about these issues, and that is that the approach of the West to the Ukraine war, as contrasted to its approach to the genocide in Gaza, has left no doubt in any rational observer's mind, and anybody who has any contact with reality at all, that the West is just the leadership of the West. These are people who are utterly depraved and have taken hypocrisy to an unimaginable level, because, you know, the civilian death toll in Gaza is far worse than the civilian death toll in Ukraine, even though the Ukraine war has been going on for over 2 years and the genocide in Gaza has been taking place over a period of a little bit in excess of 5 months. The level of destruction of civilian facilities is vastly worse in Gaza than it is in Ukraine. I mean, they haven't flattened Kiev. If it was Israel that was attacking Ukraine and it was applying to Ukraine the same approach that it's applying to Gaza, Kiev would have been flattened by now. Literally 2/3 to 3/4 of it would be unlivable. That's not even remotely the case. So even if you take the view that the invasion of Ukraine was unprovoked, even if you take the view that it was illegal, and certainly the claim that it was unprovoked is highly, highly debatable, as you and I have discussed, Chris. But even if you take that view, just looking at the impacts upon the civilian population, there should be no doubt in anybody's mind that what's being done in Gaza is far worse. And what are we doing? What are we doing with Gaza? We're not imposing any sanctions on Israel. And even more so, we're giving them the weapons. Yeah. Even Canada's giving them weapons and purchasing weapons from them at the same time as they're committing this genocide. And in the case of Russia, we've imposed every imaginable sanction and then some on the Russian Federation, even though the sanctions have failed to achieve any of their objectives. And with respect to Navalny in particular, Navalny was actually in many ways an odious character. Now, that doesn't mean that he should have been killed, but it's not clear that he was killed, mm-hmm. because even the military intelligence director of Ukraine, Kirill Budanov, told the Ukrainian press a couple of weeks ago that his information was that Navalny actually did die of a blood clot. So if the head of the Ukrainian military intelligence is telling you that this man died, you know, he is as fierce an adversary of Vladimir Putin and his government as you can imagine, Kirill Budanov. If he's saying this, then shouldn't we at least question whether, in fact, Vladimir Putin ordered his death? And why would he do it? Why would he do it when almost nobody was paying any attention to Navalny in Russia at the time? Putin was weeks away from an election. And at the very moment when Navalny died, Russia was on the verge of taking Avdiivka, which was a major victory, and the death of Navalny handed to the West an opportunity to distract attention from the battlefield and to launch a renewed propaganda campaign against Putin. So there's good reason to doubt that that was actually his death was ordered by Putin. I don't know myself. I have no idea what happened. But it certainly hasn't been demonstrated that Navalny was killed by Putin. And look at look how the Western governments reacted on a suspicion. We know for a certainty that Israel's committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. This is a certainty. We have ample evidence. And what are we doing? We're arming them. So, I mean, we've gone beyond hypocrisy. There are no words to describe at this stage how insincere and how disingenuous Western governments are.
Well, and the people in Canada, they're opposing what's going on in Gaza and opposing Israel and opposing the arms transfer from Canada to Israel. There's been a lot less talk about the arms coming the other way and Canada sending money to buy missiles. from that country. Melanie Joly, our foreign minister, is in the West Bank. I think she's still there. She has been sending, tweeting missives from there, pictures of herself hugging children and saying, well, in one instance, the children are our future, not even that they're their own future, or they're their own present, living in a hellscape created by her ally, Israel. Have you had a chance to follow Madame Jolie's progress, or Genocide Jolie, as I like to call her?
Yeah, very apt term. I was a couple of days just before I left for the West Bank, I checked and I wasn't able to see any information about her itinerary. And frankly, Chris, I've just been so absorbed by what I'm watching, what I'm actually seeing. I mean, I would say, you know, if by any chance she ever listens to this interview, I think that Madame Jolie needs to visit one of these refugee camps and see with her own eyes what's happening there. You know, going to Ramallah or wherever else she's gone, I can't imagine she has stepped foot in Jenin or that she's stepped foot in Tulkarm. I can't imagine that she's seen any of the refugee camps where these atrocities are occurring. She's putting on a show. The Trudeau government is engaged in kabuki theater. They are not prepared to impose sanctions on Israel that are at least as severe as those that they have imposed upon Russia. Then, frankly, they should just shut up, because all they're doing is distracting attention from their own depravity. That's all they're doing. So I think their language at this stage has become completely devoid of credibility. Nobody, again, who is in touch with reality is buying it. These people like Genocide Jolie and Genocide Justin, I think that they live in some kind of alternate universe, Chris, because they actually seem to believe that their rhetoric is still plausible. It ceased to be plausible long ago. They need to either shut up or put up.
Yeah, another universe might be the only place they have left to live by the end of all of this. Well, Dmitry, you've written like 8 or 10 pieces in the last week or so. Again, you've been on this trip through the region. The first piece I'm looking at right now is Cyprus, Britain's unsinkable warship. And in that, you talk about Cyprus being used as a base for Britain and a drone base that is aiding and abetting in this genocide in Gaza. Today, I see a headline that there is a aid ship leaving Cyprus. This is at Al Jazeera. The Open Arms is the name of the ship. We talked last year, it seems like a million years ago, when you were on board one of the flotilla ships planning to do the same thing. Have you followed the Open Arms and its journey from Larnaca, and its hope to send, to take a barge full of flour, rice, and other things to Gaza?
Well, the last report I saw, which was either 2 days ago or yesterday, was that departure of the ship was expected to be delayed because of defects in the vessel, or, you know, the fact it apparently there was some question about whether it was even seaworthy. But again, let's suppose that the thing is ready to roll and it actually is capable of reaching the shores of Gaza. This, again, is just kabuki theater, Chris. There are trucks aplenty sitting at the Rafah border crossing. They're lined up waiting to go in. The problem is that the Israelis would not allow them in, and even if they were, nor will the Egyptian dictator Sisi, and even if they were to get into Gaza, there's absolutely no way for the population to access them safely, because the Israelis have repeatedly attacked aid convoys and murdered in cold blood people who are desperately trying to access what little aid is getting into the Gaza Strip. So unless and until, all we have to do is literally just stop sending weapons to Israel and say no more bombs, no more economic aid, no more vetoes for you at the UN Security Council. The gig is up, and the aid will flow in unimpeded, and people will be able to access it safely without any ships having to cross the Mediterranean, not a single one, without any silly ports having to be built on the shores of Gaza. We can get the aid in. The problem is that we will not oblige the Israelis to let it in, even though we have the power to do that. So this is just kabuki theater, and nobody should be deceived by that or by that silly port that Biden says he wants to build.
Or the airdrops. You were in Jordan recently, and it was very broadly broadcast here, the King Hussein taking part in dropping aid supplies on the beaches. This is before one of them went awry, that the Americans went dropping a crate on killing five people on the ground. Again, with theater.
Absolutely. I mean, the quantity of the aid, first of all, how much aid can you airdrop in? I mean, to get enough aid to the people that actually helped them, you probably end up crushing thousands of them, dropping these huge cartons or these huge, bins from the sky. There's no need to do any of that. Absolutely no need. It's dangerous and it's inefficient and it's inadequate. So what the hell are these people thinking? Do they actually believe that we don't see through this charade anymore? It is absolutely clear that they can stop this humanitarian disaster, this man-made humanitarian disaster, with a phone call from Biden to Netanyahu. No more bombs, no more economic aid, no more vetoes for you at the UN Security Council, Bibi. That's all it's going to take. The rest of this is nonsense and distraction.
Well, did King Hussein have to do this? I mean, his political position in Jordan must be fraught right now with the country providing the land corridor to Israel for supplies because of blockades of the Red Sea going on, thanks to the Houthis. His position, did you get a sense when you were there that his position is tenuous?
I would say so. Now, I didn't see what I saw in Lebanon when I arrived there in October of last year. What I saw when I arrived in Lebanon was street warfare, basically. Thousands of irate protesters were descending upon the United States Embassy and engaged in running street battles with riot police. I didn't see that in Jordan. But I did see a large protest outside the Grand Husseini Mosque in Amman, and it was the 23rd consecutive week when that protest took place. And they were openly, now it wasn't violent, but they were openly criticizing Jordanian government policy. And they were doing this after the Jordanian government had arrested thousands of participants in these protests. In February, both Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch on the same day denounced the Jordanian government for repressing these protests. So when you look at the context, the fact that people were absolutely risking arrest, and a reliable source in Jordan, in Amman, told me one of the tactics that the Jordanian monarchy employs to repress dissent by Palestinians is to threaten to take away or to actually take away their Jordanian citizenship, the Jordanians of Palestinian origin. So these people are dealing with very significant threats to their freedom and to their mobility, to their right to live in Jordan. And nonetheless, thousands of them take to the streets and directly and expressly denounce the Jordanian government. So I think the Jordanian government is on thin ice. I think that's also true of the Egyptian dictatorship. I think that's true of the Saudi monarchy. I can't say with any degree of confidence whether there's going to be a serious attempt to overthrow any one of them. And maybe there won't be because they are so repressive. But in the current circumstances, Chris, anything is possible. And I think they're well aware of that.
Yeah, El-Sisi must have trouble sleeping at nights. At least I think I would if I was him. Well, we're fast running out of time, Dimitri. Can you say what your next destination is, or would you rather just keep that close to the vest?
I'm trying not to foreshadow to people who might be opposed to my journey. Yes. Where I'm going to go next. But I'm going to be moving on from Jenin.
Well, I'm sure it will be fascinating. DimitriLascaris.org. Go to his website, get links, find him with the same name at YouTube to get a look at his videos. Thanks a lot for coming on the show again, Dimitri.
Thanks again for having me, Chris. Take care.
My great pleasure, and I want everyone to stay tuned because after the break, TJ Coles will be up and we'll talk about his book, The New Atheism Hoax.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago. Jakarta. Helsinki. Cape Town. Sao Paulo. Manchester. Bangalore. And somewhere in Russia, I can't actually remember the name.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, there's been an effort to paint the genocide in Gaza and growing pogrom in the communities of the West Bank and East Jerusalem in the colors of a religious war. The Battle of Civilizations narrative is a familiar one. We've heard it variously intoned during all of the many conflicts the United States and its allies have fomented across the so-called arc of instability for the last 20 years and more. And each time it's been a lie. But to what purpose? Dr. T.J. Coles is the director of the Plymouth Institute for Peace Research and the author of numerous books, including The War on You, Manufacturing Terrorism, Capitalism, and Coronavirus, How Institutionalized Greed Turned a